Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's stream. We are live tonight on Odyssey, DLive, Rumble, and Entropy. And it's going to be an interesting one tonight, so if you can help me out by sharing it, that would be very, very much appreciated. Now, tonight's stream, as you know, is going to be all about Nigel Farage and Rupert Lowe. And obviously, at the end, I'll be taking questions. Now, if you would like to contribute to the stream, if you'd like to donate, if you would like to give a financial gift, that would be very, very welcome and gratefully received. Now, you can donate via Odyssey or through Entropy, or you can send cryptocurrency after the show. The links for that are in the description below. Now, if you've got any questions or comments about what I'm saying tonight, I will answer them at the end of my presentation, as I always do. Now, I understand that people might have input or things to say that are but don't have the money to donate or don't want to donate. So at the end, when I've answered any paid super chats or any financial contributions, I would be more than happy to let the chat run for a little bit and take unpaid questions from the chat as well, because this is an important topic. So we'll go as long as we need to, and it's not going to be something where questions are paywalled. It's not going to have something with a hard time limit on. And if people do have things to raise at the end, the things that they're raising, as I say, you know, it's either an Odyssey token or it's a question that isn't supported with a super chat, that's fine. I'll answer those at the end. But as always, if you do want to financially contribute, that is very, very much appreciated. Now, we've got past that bit, and I want to get into a little bit of a disclaimer. I usually do these disclaimers at the beginning of any stream. Now, what this stream isn't is very important. This stream is not an endorsement of Nigel Farage, and it's also not necessarily an endorsement of Rupert Lowe. Now, I think a lot of people are thinking that I'm coming on here tonight to bury Nigel Farage and say Rupert Lowe's the way forward and we've all got to get behind him. And that has been what some people have said, but that isn't what this stream's about. This stream is about me talking truthfully about the history of Nigel Farage, the things he's achieved, the fallouts he's had in the past, where he came from politically, what he built up, and to paint him in the most truthful way possible from a nationalist point of view. And that's because I've seen a lot of content creators, you know, talking about this. And in part, this is a response to those content creators, because content creators are making videos on reform and Farage, but I'm not really sure whether they know much about him. And I'm also not sure how long those people have been involved in the movement, because I've been involved in the movement since the year 2000, just after Nigel Farage was elected for the first time for the European Parliament. And I've sort of tracked his career since then, because his career ran parallel with his career and growth ran parallel with that of our growth in the BNP, and it was something that affected our growth. So we always kept an eye on Farage and what he was doing, and I was there when a lot of things happened. I was there when there was a lot of bust-ups, a lot of big wins for him, you know, times when he seemed to disappear. And we're going to talk about all of that, and we're going to put it all in the right context so you can judge what's going on now. And I think that's really, really important. So we're going to focus on Farage's career, the people who came and went throughout his career, how he rose to the top. And all this is going to be based on facts. And then we're going to go into his modern day split, his modern day bust up with Rupert Lowe. And then after that, we're going to have a look at where the land lies now. And then we're going to do something which hopefully will be quite fun. And that's going to be a little bit of theory crafting and speculation, where this could all go, who this benefits, etc. So let's get into it. And we're going to start with Farage, the early years. Now, this might shock you. This might shock you. But Farage was, in fact, a banker. I'm sure that's not going to shock anyone. He was involved in the financial markets. He was somebody involved in the kind of, should we call it, industry, the money markets. And we know who also is involved in the money markets. And we know the kind of people that are drawn to the money markets. And a lot of people make a big deal Farage is a former banker. He was involved in sort of stock exchange and financial institutions. Immediately, he's not one of us and can't be trusted. Now, I don't know enough about that aspect of Nigel Farage's life, so I'm not actually going to comment on that. But we are going to come back to it later. So I want you to remember what I've said here. Farage was involved in banking and financial industries. He is someone who was heavily caught up with all of that. He's got large investments, allegedly. And, you know, but remember that we're not holding him against him now. And there'll be a reason for that, which we'll come back to. So let's start with when I first heard of Nigel Farage, because a lot of this is going to be from my point of view, sort of 25 years in politics, and most of them have been with Nigel Farage sort of hovering around the nationalist scene, being accused of being controlled opposition, and definitely acting as a blockade towards genuine nationalist parties taking any form of power. Now, the first time I think the world really heard of Nigel Farage, and people have probably heard of him before because he's quite a charismatic guy, but the first time he really, really came to prominence was in the 1999 European elections. Now, for sake of ease, what I'm going to do when I bring up the election results and show you how his career changed over time, I'm going to use Wikipedia. Now, Wikipedia isn't always the most accurate place, but for election results and things like that, it's a great resource. You can go there. You can put your fingertips straight on the election results. So I'm going to bring this up, make it a little bit bigger. Now, 1999, the European election here in the UK, was a very important election. And it was an important election because it was a new kind of election. 1999 was the first year the European elections were held. And they were held on a system of proportional representation. So it was a nationwide election, like a general election, but held via a system of proportional representation. So it was meant to be much fairer. It was meant to give an accurate gauge of how people felt across the country. It wasn't first past the post. You know, you didn't have one candidate winning with 36% of the vote and locking out everyone else. You had a system which was meant to represent people in different areas of the UK more accurately, and those representatives went to Brussels. They sat in the European Parliament. And this was, as I said, the first time when Nigel Farage really, really came to the fore. Because UKIP, and Nigel Farage was not the leader of UKIP at this time. You can actually see here, I've put it up on screen, 1999 European election. The leader of UKIP at the time was Michael Holmes. And UKIP won three seats. It got 6.5%, nearly 700,000 votes. And UKIP came in there doing probably its first ever major bit of business. You can see here the Conservatives took 33% of the vote, Labour 26%. And UKIP ended up fourth. And fourth place was very, very credible. 6.5% of the national vote, as I said, and three people elected. Now, one of those people elected was Nigel Farage. And this sort of catapulted Nigel Farage into the limelight, because Nigel Farage was a very, very charismatic man. And of the three candidates elected in 1999, Farage became sort of the poster boy for the party. He was the one running around doing interviews. He has a lot of energy. I mean, I couldn't tell you anything about, forgot his name already, Michael Holmes. I couldn't tell you anything about Michael Holmes. And that's not to besmirch the guy. I don't know anything about him. And I couldn't tell you anything about him. I'd forgotten him. He sort of, even though he was the leader of UKIP when they made this initial breakthrough, he seems to have sort of been forgotten to time, but Farage wasn't. He had all this energy and he was buzzing around everywhere doing interviews. Every time somebody seemed to appear on the TV representing UKIP, it was Nigel. Nigel at the time was this young, energetic sort of go-getter that talked the talk. People warmed to him very quickly and he became a household name over time, especially when it came to presenting Eurosceptic arguments. So Farage, although not the leader in 1999, he was seen as this sort of, growing power in the party and sort of rising star, if you will. And if you look down there, UKIP came fourth, but the BNP, they took 100,000 votes and they took 1%. Now, the BNP had high hopes for that election because they'd long talked about the need for proportional representation, but they didn't do particularly well. They were beaten by a number of parties, including Sinn Féin, the SNP, the Greens, Plaid Cymru, but comfortably beaten by UKIP. And obviously, they didn't get anyone elected. Now, I joined the BNP in the year 2000. And the BNP started gathering real steam in 2002 when we got three councillors elected in Burnley. And all of a sudden, the BNP was getting more headlines than UKIP. Everyone was talking about the BNP, and we were regularly making the news. UKIP weren't, however, but Farage would pop up for interviews and things, but the BNP was sort of more of the talk of the town at that time. And I remember the party's goal, even back as far as 2002, was to prepare for 2004, to get council seats, to prepare ourselves for 2004, because in 2004, we believed UKIP would effectively disappear. And that was an interesting thing. Nick Griffin was like, UKIP will disappear, we'll win these council seats, we'll be the talk of the town, UKIP will disappear, and the BNP in 2004, we will come of age, the proportional representation will work for us for a change, and we will get people in. And there was a lot of worry in the establishment that Nick Griffin would get elected in 2004, that Simon Darby would get elected in the West Mids, that Nick Cass would get elected in Yorkshire, and that there would be a slew of BNP MEPs, and we would be the big party representing sort of the dissident right in Europe, the big British party. And as the 2004 European elections sort of started gathering pace, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Nigel Farage appeared everywhere. So up until the beginning of 2004, all anyone talked about was the BNP. BNP were making gains in councils up and down the country. We were polling very strongly. We had a number of councillors in Burnley. We had councillors by that time in Blackburn and Halifax. And, you know, people were voting for us, you know, in large numbers in places like Bradford, all the mill towns in the northwest, and it seemed as if we were on the cusp of something great. But then Nigel Farage was wheeled out, and the media loved him. And UKIP had a lot of money. Everywhere you turned, there was UKIP billboards, vote UKIP, and Farage still wasn't the leader of UKIP. Actually, at the time, the leader of UKIP was a guy called Roger Knapman. And Roger Knapman, again, another guy that's largely been forgotten to time, was the guy in charge. But Farage was the poster boy. And I remember back in 2004, no one was talking about Roger Knapman. They were all talking about this incredibly sort of passionate guy who was whizzing around doing all these interviews, who seemed to be the face of the party. And that was Nigel Farage. But Nigel Farage was joined by somebody else in 2004. It wasn't just the Nigel Farage show. He was heavily touted as this sort of superstar candidate for them. You know, the young go-getter, the one that you wanted to listen to in the interviews, the guy who would, you know, come on and debate pundits and stuff like that. But he was joined by someone else. Now, in 2004, a man named Robert Kilroy Silk, who some of you may remember, and they'll remember him because Robert Kilroy Silk was a national name. He was a household name. He was a famous guy. He worked for the BBC. He did a morning chat show called Kilroy that dealt with things like social issues, politics, was a bit of debate. And Robert Kilroy Silk came out and said, yeah, I'm getting on board with UKIP. And everywhere you looked, this just blew up. And overnight, the BNP were completely eclipsed. So the BNP were this rising group, you know, 1999, that was UKIP's time. 2004, this is going to be the year of the BNP. But then out of nowhere, Farage is everywhere. Robert Kilroy Silk joins him. They form this kind of dream team. As I say, you're not really seeing much of the UKIP leader, Roger Knapman, but you are seeing Farage and Kilroy Silk absolutely everywhere. And UKIP did very well. The BNP didn't get any seats. It was a disaster for us. But for UKIP, they did very well. And you can see here the results. We'll go down to the results. Now, the Conservatives, again, won less 7.6%. Labour, less 4.4%. But UKIP went from 700,000 votes in the previous election to 2.65 million votes in 2004. And they went from three seats to 12. This was incredible. And this was largely credited, not to UKIP's leader, but to this power couple that were Farage and Kilroy Silk. Now, at the time, this was disastrous for the BNP. People left the BNP. There was a mass exodus from the party. The party hit the buffers with money. I remember Nick Griffin was, I mean, he probably won't want me saying this, but he was depressed about it. He was down in the dumps. I mean, I was down in the dumps. Everyone was. We were convinced we were going to win, but UKIP had come and stolen our thunder. The media had built them up. And as I said, he'd had this power couple, which was Farage and Kilroy Silk. They were the ones leading the charge of Euroscepticism. And it all seemed, for them, like a match made in heaven. And this is the first time when Farage had a big public falling out with somebody. So as I said, Farage was not the leader, but he was the poster boy, the hero of UKIP, the man that they had touted as their sort of number one. Never the leader, but sort of the most valuable player, if you like. Then out of nowhere, Kilroy Silk joins UKIP. Him and Farage are best of friends. But then they had a big falling out. And it's quite actually interesting what they fell out over. Kilroy Silk made this statement that the next stage for UKIP was to completely destroy the Conservative Party. He actually was, for somebody who was a BBC presenter, was quite a radical. And not a radical in the way you would think a BBC presenter would be. He wasn't some sort of left-wing lovey who wanted to bring about, you know, some communist state. Quite the opposite. He came out and said something that I repeatedly said. He said that the only way to effect real change in Britain was to destroy the Conservative Party. It was for UKIP to completely destroy the Conservative Party, shatter them, stand against them at every opportunity, reduce them to nothing and replace them. Now that, for any nationalist, should have been a moment of punching the air. That should have been everyone saying, yes, yes, that's what we need to do. But there was one person who wasn't. So you had this quite radical Kilroy Silk, best friends with Nigel Farage, this power couple. But this upset Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage did not like the idea of smashing the Conservative Party. In fact, Nigel Farage, he was more friendly with them. He wanted to steer them. He potentially wanted some form of coalition. He wanted to work with them, maybe get to a position where he was calling the shots in that party. And he didn't like Robert Kilroy Silk's talk of radicalism and smashing the establishment. And they had a massive, massive bust-up about it. Now, this massive bust-up actually led to one of these two sort of superstar candidates leaving UKIP. And UKIP actually split. Kilroy Silk, I think he took one other MEP with him. It might have been two. He definitely took with him one of the UKIP's London Assembly members, and they all left together to form their own party called Veritas. So they got elected in 2004, but by 2005, this honeymoon was over, and a new party had been formed, and the guy at the head of it was a nationally known household name, former BBC presenter, who was talking about destroying the Conservatives. And Farage couldn't stand him. The two could not stand each other. And at that point, a lot of people said, well, this is going to be the end. This is the end for UKIP. This is the end for Farage. You know, Kilroy Silk, he's going to be the man that, you know, leads something that sweeps them aside. And by the end of 2005, I think Veritas was more or less wound up, and Kilroy Silk, he remained on as an MEP, but he sort of quit leader of the party. I think he quit Veritas altogether and realised that there was no doing this. Farage just steamrolled at him and destroyed him. And Farage has a habit of doing that. He's a very, very smooth operator. So not only had Farage crushed the BNP in 2004 because the media had built him up along with Kilroy Silk, but then Farage and Kilroy Silk had fallen out. And by 2005, they were bitter enemies, and Kilroy Silk was had started a party, then quit a party. You know, he quit two parties. He started, you know, quit UKIP, started his own party, Veritas, and then quit that as leader. And at this point, I remember people in the BNP saying, well, that's it. UKIP are done. What a complete farce. The party has split. Farage has fallen out with Kilroy Silk. This is it for them. They are done. And in some respects, they appeared that way. They didn't get as much publicity as they had previously got. And leading up to the 2009 European election, I remember Nick Griffin and other people in the party saying, look, UKIP and Farage are finished. They fooled the people in 2004. They got in 1999, then the media built them up in 2004. They fooled the people, but the people will now understand what Farage and UKIP are, that there was all these fallings out, there was the splits, they were very ineffective when they got in, a number of their MEPs sort of defected or just threw the towel in and, you know, basically did nothing but collect, their paychecks. And the BNP, the mindset in the BNP was that that was it for Farage and UKIP, that 2009 was going to be the year of the BNP. But by now, Nigel Farage had actually taken over UKIP. He was now the leader of UKIP. He was actually in charge. And I remember sitting at meetings with, Nick Griffin and other key BNP personnel, and people were sort of looking at the maps and saying, look, we're definitely going to win one here. We're definitely going to win one here. We could have two in the northwest if we're lucky. We probably win one in the southeast. You know, we can definitely win in the West Midlands now. Simon Darby, I remember Nick Griffin patting Simon Darby on the back saying, don't worry, Simon, you will be in Brussels with me. You should come next year. And there was a real feeling in the party that UKIP had done everything they could, that Farage had been damaged by constant splits, infighting, the ineffectiveness of his MEPs, and of course the big bust up with Kilroy Silk. And how could the media build him up again? The media built him up in 2004, and then there was all this drama. People wouldn't buy it again, would they? People wouldn't buy it in 2009 and, you know, be suckered into voting for him again. Well, plot twist, they were. In 2009, UKIP did even better than they had done in 2004. The BNP were absolutely convinced that they were going to win seats. Nick Griffin was convinced that the BNP was going to sort of sweep to power. Now, the BNP did get two candidates elected, but we were all thinking that that was it, Farage done. But just before the European elections, the media couldn't get enough of Nigel Farage. And all you had on TV was wall-to-wall Farage. Every newspaper, every chat show, every discussion panel. And I've got to give it to Nigel Farage. Now, this isn't me kissing up to him. It's just the truth. He's an energetic leader, an energetic man. If there was a way for him to promote himself, if there was a place he could give an interview, if there was a group of people that would listen to him, he would be there. And he was very, very good at putting his points over. And in the run-up to the election, all you saw everywhere was UKIP posters, billboards. They were everywhere, and the public loved it. And you know what I'm going to do next, don't you? I'm going to scroll to the results. Scroll to the results time. That's what you're saying. What were the results? Well, UKIP did even better. Now, they actually got slightly fewer votes this time than they did at the last election. But it's not about how many votes you get. It's about the percentage. You know, it doesn't matter your raw votes. In fact, raw votes are the least important thing. The thing that matters most is the position you come, usually, in this not so much because it's proportional representation. But percentage and positioning matter more than raw votes. So you get slightly fewer votes, but they went up to 16%, 13 MEPs, the growth of just one this time, but they were pushed into second place. And you can see there on the chart, Conservatives won again, but UKIP beat Labour into third place. And this was massive. You had this very young, energetic, go-getting Nigel Farage, who had always been sort of the superstar candidate, but never trusted with leadership, had this big bust-up with Kilroy Silk. People said he was done. Then took control of the party, and it was almost like a fairy tale. It's like his destiny. He leads UKIP to second place in a major national election. Now, to my knowledge, post-Second World War, I don't think either at this point, either Labour or the Conservatives had been pushed out of first or second place in a major national election. And here is this energetic upstart who seems to disappear for 4 years, only to be resurrected, only to rise from the grave like Lazarus, you know, in the fifth year when campaigning begins for the European parliamentary elections. And he's back. He's back and he's come second place. And this kind of cemented Nigel Farage as the Eurosceptic man, the big face on sort of the patriotic or dissident right. You know, he eclipsed, obviously, Nick Griffin, anyone else. He was this power player. And I remember being elated when Nick Griffin and Andrew Bronze were elected to the European Parliament. Because as you can see here, the BNP did very well. This was the BNP's best ever polling. You know, we came sixth nationally and took nearly a million votes. I mean, this was phenomenal. 6.2% of the vote. That was at the high point for the British National Party. And I was there actually at the count when Andrew Bronze got elected. And it came to a point in the night when a friend of mine leant over to me and said, look, Mark, we've got so many votes now. There's not enough districts left for anyone to overtake us. We're definitely getting a seat. And we were like, this is incredible. I remember ringing people saying, we've actually won it. It's not announced yet, but we've won it. But whatever we did, it was massively eclipsed by UKIP. And that's not to pour scorn on what we achieved. It's just to be realistic. Nigel Farage had, you know, done the unthinkable. And that was it. As leader, he was leading this massive group into the European Parliament, 13 MEPs. And yeah, it was big. And what happened next? Well, splits, fallouts, bad feelings in the party. You know, over the next 5 years, UKIP lost 45% of their MEPs. 45% of their MEPs either resigned from UKIP, went off to start their own little minor parties or whatever, because they couldn't work with Nigel Farage. These splits and fallouts essentially crippled the party. So 2009 to 2014 was another series of damaging bloodlettings. You know, so we've obviously had the Kilroy Silk fallout, but now 45% of his MEPs have left. And at this point, again, people were writing the guy off. And I've got to give him some credit at this point, some credit. He's achieved these two big wins where he's come third and then second. He's achieved these two great things. But people in the party actually weren't happy with him. They were saying, look, we're losing MEPs. The party isn't taking the right direction outside of European elections. We're not achieving what we should. And you know what Farage did? And this is, again, to his credit. This, again, is to his credit. He said, right, if you don't want me as leader, you know, I'll focus on my job in the European Parliament. And he quit. He actually quit as leader. He remained a member of UKIP, but he quit as leader. And Malcolm Pearson briefly took over between 2009 and 2010. And during his tenure as UKIP leader, what do you think happened? Well, Nigel took a back seat. He retired to his European parliamentary post and Malcolm Pearson took over. This was meant to be a fresh start. This was meant to be put the Farage years behind us. Farage is still with us, but there aren't going to be any more splits or fallouts. And Malcolm Pearson annoyed everyone. He annoyed everyone more than Nigel Farage, because in the 2010 general election, Malcolm Pearson comes up with this idea of, well, we're going to do an electoral deal with both the Tories and Labour. And if the Tories are standing a Eurosceptic candidate, or the Labour are, UKIP won't stand against them. People in UKIP were furious. They were like, well, we're here to replace these parties. We're not here to do deals with them. You know, we're not here to help these other parties. And it didn't last very long. And shortly afterwards, Nigel Farage comes back. So after the general election in November 2010, Nigel Farage comes back as leader of UKIP. And I know what you're saying. He's done this twice. Nige has been there twice at the forefront of the party. He's led them twice to these fantastic electoral victories. Third place, then second place. Can he possibly do better? Probably not. He's lost 45% of his MEPs. People in the party, you know, were annoyed enough to force him to stand down in 2009. When Malcolm Pearson came in, you know, there were still people who probably remembered Kilroy Silk. What on earth could Nigel do? Surely Nigel Farage couldn't do better than second place. It would be unthinkable for a party outside of Labour and the Conservatives to win a major national election. Well, you can tell what I'm doing here. It's called foreshadowing, because that's exactly what happened. In 2014, despite him losing 45% of his MEPs between 2009 and 2014, Farage rises again like the phoenix from the flames to lead UKIP, not just to a credible third or second place finish, but to an emphatic victory. Yes, the first time in the history of British politics, a minor party without any MPs wins a major national election. So scroll mark down to the results and let's see what happened. Where are the results? How far do you have to go? Here you go. UKIP balloons to 4.376 million votes, 26.6%, taking first place, 24 seats, comfortably first place, with Labour coming second with 4 million votes, taking 20 seats, and the Conservatives with nearly 3.8 million, taking 19 seats. And Farage had cemented himself in electoral history. Farage had, and the BNP there absolutely crushed down to 1.1%. They lost their MEPs. Very, very sad. I was out of the party by that time. But there you can see Nigel Farage cementing himself in British political history. He's taken the party from, you know, three MEPs when he was just sort of like this young go-getter in 1999, and 15 years later, he's led that party, he's taken it over, he's survived the splits, the bloodletting, and he's taken that party over, and they've won a major national election. Now, as I said, I'm not here to kiss anyone's backside, but credit where credit's due. That was an absolutely unbelievable victory. No one else has achieved anything like that. Not John Tyndall, not Nick Griffin, not so Oswald Mosley. You know, this is bigger than anything Enoch Powell did. He's just won a major national election as an outsider. And this is so big This is so incredible. This is so seismic that David Cameron, leader of the Conservative Party, is so completely shook by this result, being pushed into third place. Remember, last time they came first, that he says, right, I want all the UKIP voters to come back to the Tories, so we're going to offer you an in-out referendum on Britain's membership of the EU. This is the election, Nigel Farage winning the 2014 European parliamentary election in the UK, is what triggered the Brexit vote. So Farage has not only taken this small party to victory at a major national election, but he's also triggered this once in a lifetime referendum on the future of Britain's international relationship with the European Union. Now, this is an incredible amount for a man to achieve. And you can't just set this to one side, because it happened. Now, in 2015, Nigel Farage then said he was going to stand in the general election, and he's in charge of UKIP. And he said, look, I'm going to go for this, a big win. I'm going to get elected to Parliament. We will have MPs, not just MEPs, but proper MPs sitting in Westminster. And he predicted he would win his seat, which at the time was Thanet, in the general election. And people said to him, if you don't win, what are you going to do? If you don't win Thanet, what are you going to do, Nigel? And Nigel came out and says, if I don't win, I'm resigning as leader of UKIP. I'm done. I'll stay with the party. I'll lead the MEPs in Brussels, but I'm resigning. And he didn't win Thanet. And to his credit, he followed through. It wasn't an empty promise. He resigned as leader of UKIP in 2015. He said, look, enough's enough. I'm done. And that was it. He was out. And in came lots of other people. Now, obviously, Brexit happened. But here's some of the, you know, Brexit happened in 2016, and Nigel Farage led Britain really to Brexit. So that's the other thing he achieved. He achieved Britain's exit from the European Union. Again, not only did he win a major national election, not only did he trigger a once in a lifetime chance to vote in a national referendum, but then he went on to win that national referendum. So he's clocking up these big wins. But there were a series of people who took over. There was Diane James. Does anyone remember her? Probably not. She lasted a month. No, she didn't. I'm talking nonsense. She lasted 21 days. She didn't even last a month. She lasted 3 weeks. I remember Diane James. She was a female. She was meant to present a softer image for the party. And I'll tell you what, she went out and did an interview. Somebody called her a racist and spat in her face. She threw the towel in, and that was the end of Diane James. She never came back. Diane James never came back after being spat at. She left. Then there was Paul Nuttall. He came in from November 2016 to June 2017. Paul was a very close friend and sort of the wingman of Nigel. And I think he was a good guy. He was personable. He seemed likable, but he was a bit wacky. And the press picked him up on a couple of false statements. He said he knew people who died in the Hillsborough disaster. He had personal friends who died in the Hillsborough disaster. And allegedly that turned out not to be true. And he was crucified by the press. And after that, and after an unsuccessful parliamentary by-election, he was gone. Then a guy called Steve Crowther comes in June 2017 to September 2017. That was a disaster too. Short, uneventful. And then the next guy who steps up is a guy called Henry Bolton. Now, Henry Bolton lasted in the role from September 2017 to February 2018. Still not a long time to be in charge of a political party. And he was a disaster too. So Henry Bolton comes in. And Henry Bolton's got a wife, he's got children. I think he was a decorated British military officer. You know, seems like the kind of guy you would want sort of leading a party. And what happened to old Henry Bolton? Well, you might remember there was a young, a relatively attractive girl called Jo Marnie. He jumps into bed with her behind his wife's back, abandons his kids, abandons his wife, runs off with Jo Marnie. This was a complete scandal. You know, you can't really hold a guy like that in high regard. I mean, look, you know, the guy's in his 50s, 20-year-old girl draping herself all over him. It's going to be gratifying. And I'm not saying a guy shouldn't be like, whoa, yeah, you know, the women still like me. But abandoning your wife and kids and actually going and following through on it is a different thing altogether. You know, every guy likes younger women, you know, flirting with them. But abandoning your wife and kids for a younger woman, especially when you're meant to be a principled man leading a traditionalist political party, is reprehensible. So Bolton didn't last, and everyone thought he was a bit of a div. And that's me putting it politely. And the next guy who comes in was Gerard Batten. So Gerard Batten comes in 2018. And he tries to take the party in a different direction. He tries to take the party in this direction of more sort of alt-right. He brings new people on. He brings sort of what were known as sort of dissident right influencers, people like Count Dankula and Sargon of Akkadon. He brought them in, and he was very, very bullish about, you know, talking about Islam, talking about mass immigration. And he seemed like the based guy. And in certain sort of circles, everyone was like, hey, you know, this is fantastic. Gerard Batten's talking about radical Islam. He's talking about the Islamification of Europe. He's talking about mass immigration. You know, Sargon of Akkad jumped on board. He brought his sizable support base with him. Same with Count Dankula. And the next thing, Batten's talking to Tommy Robinson. He's having chats with Tommy Robinson. Tommy Robinson's banned from joining the party. So Batten appoints him as his special advisor on Islam. And that's it for Farage. Farage has had enough. Farage can't stand Tommy Robinson. And in, I think it was 2018, Farage said enough's enough. And he finally left UKIP, the party he initially was elected for in 1999, that he'd led to actual victory, that he'd built up, that he'd brought about the Brexit vote with, that he'd campaigned under to achieve Brexit. He finally leaves UKIP. And people are saying, what is he going to do next? And this set up a big showdown at the 2019 European parliamentary elections between Farage's new party, the Brexit Party, and UKIP, which was meant to be much more based now, much more sort of like in line with the kind of thing that we might think it. I mean, Batten in some ways is more similar to Rupert Lowe today. There's sort of a, you know, a parallel there. And Batten also was more intent on sort of like, yeah, we've got to get rid of the establishment, similar to Kilroy Silk. So you can see here that Farage falls out with these people. And Farage then says, look, you know, there's going to be a new party. Screw UKIP. And people are saying, well, what's going to happen? You're going to have Farage's new organisation, the Brexit Party. He's got a year, well, I think it was in the end, it was like sort of almost months to build up. How's Farage going to build up a party in months and take on the established household name of UKIP, especially when UKIP's got all this new blood, all these new young people are joining. You've got Sargon, Dankula, Tommy Robinson endorsing them. You know, they're all going hard for this. And everyone's thinking, this is it. Farage is done. The Brexit Party won't be able to, you know, or Farage won't be able to, you know, repeat his big wins under the Brexit Party. Well, you know what I'm going to say next? Wrong. Here comes Farage. Here comes the Farage train. Choo-choo. He wins his second major national election outright, doing even better under the Brexit Party banner than he ever did under UKIP. Now, I'm trying to find the results in full. Here you are. Brexit Party smashes it. Nearly 5.25 million votes. 30.5% of the vote absolutely decimates the Conservatives. The Conservative Party is pushed into fifth place. The Liberal Democrats come second because they're the ones saying, you know, we need to reverse Brexit. They go in for the protest vote. Labour come third. And the Brexit Party with Nigel Farage have not only pulled off his second win of a major national election, but they've helped upend the entire political system, dumping the Conservatives out of the top three, so they're not even on the finishing podium, and reducing Labour to third place. And UKIP, which was meant to be the stumbling issue, you know, could he get past a resurgent UKIP with Gerard Batten in charge? Well, UKIP were completely smashed. UKIP ended up with a vote of just 3.2%, 554,000 votes, lost every one of their 24 seats. UKIP were completely destroyed, completely destroyed. And Farage, to his credit, again, not kissing his ass, not sucking up to him. I mean, it's not like he's going to come around for tea or bring me a case of Red Bulls, is it? You know, I'm sure he can't stand people like me. I know he can't stand ethno nationalists. But here's the fact. He is an incredibly successful guy, and every time people count him out and say he's been knocked down, he comes back stronger. And boy, did he come back stronger. And that is something that throughout all the fallouts, all of the troubles, everything he's faced, he keeps coming back. And the people keep buying in to what he's selling. And this isn't like a little bit of data. This isn't sort of like, well, this happened once. This has happened consistently for 20 years. Now, that's the last European election we're going to be discussing, because it was the last European election there ever was, because Brexit. So Farage leads. So Farage, post-1999, has grown from has helped the Eurosceptic movement grow from this tiny sort of three seats in the European Parliament to winning two national elections. The second, even more emphatically than his first win. And every time, every step of the way, as you can see, and I've provided the evidence, he's been counted out only to come back. So let's have a quick recap on the man Farage. Farage is a... Well, actually, no, there's some more to say about him. Post this massive win, he actually steps down from the Brexit Party. He disappears. Brexit becomes Reform. Reform faded. Richard Tice took over, who seems like a nice but toothless guy. And Reform is, for a while, nothing. Reform are holding these tiny conferences. The last Reform Party conference under Richard Tice had not dissimilar numbers to what a Patriotic Alternative conference would have, or a BNP conference back in the day. They had about, you know, 250, 300 people at their conference, mainly old people, held in a small hall. There wasn't any buzz around them. And no one was talking about Reform. Reform were pretty much seen as this sort of Farage's leftover, as if Farage has gone and all that was left was this rump. And then at the last general election, Farage says, I'm done. I'm not standing. In 2024, Farage says, I'm never coming back. I'm not standing. And I thought to myself, well, that's going to leave a big opening in politics. And then I get a text message just before the elections, or just before the nominations are coming in. I look at my phone and think, what's this? Nigel Farage is back. And in 2024, Nigel Farage came back to the Reform Party. And he took it back from Richard Tice. He said, right, I'm taking it back over. That's it. He just snatched it back and Tice took it. And he led Reform not just to a victory at the European elections, but to five seats in a general election. Now, that might seem like small fry to you, but no party, I think, in British history that is right of the Conservative Party has ever won seats clean at a general election. There have been MPs that have crossed the floor, but never have fresh MPs been elected to Parliament under a sort of right of the Tory party banner. The National Front didn't manage it. The BNP didn't manage it. None of Mosley's outfits managed it. No one. And Farage broke that in 2024. And at this point, Reform have now got over 215,000 members. They're bigger than the Conservative Party. This is absolutely monumental. And I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again now, and it's probably the highest praise I can give Farage. I would say he's one of the three most influential post-war politicians, with the other two being Thatcher and Blair. Now, that doesn't mean I like him. Doesn't mean I agree with him. Doesn't mean I like Thatcher or Blair. But his impact on British politics has been greater, I believe, than anyone, with the exception of Blair and Thatcher, because he upended the system and he made lasting changes to the political landscape, just like Thatcher did with the miners and selling off the council houses, just like Blair did with the opening the borders and, you know, the real and the credit crunch and all the other things that happened in the Blair regime that will be remembered for a long time. But, you know, obviously the Iraq war, especially, you know, Thatcher and Blair made major changes, but so did Farage. So let's just go over that. He's had these four massive monumental achievements in his life. The first is that he's won two national elections as leader of an outsider party. The second is that he triggered Brexit. The third is that he achieved Brexit. And the fourth is that he's the first man to ever lead a right of the Tories party to, or a party that's right of the Tories, to electoral victory at a general election. And for that, you've got to say you can see why many people in Britain think he's a hero, why many people put him on this pedestal. Now, you could say he's the man, but he's not our man. He is not an ethno-nationalist. He's opposed to what we think. He has often been described as controlled opposition. Now, when you say controlled opposition, what do I mean by that? Well, there's several ways to look at controlled opposition. The first is, you know, the sort of more probably childlike way of thinking of controlled opposition. What is controlled opposition? Is it that, you know, parliamentarians, top parliamentarians, top lords, maybe a representative of the king, and, you know, the leaders of MI6 and MI5 all sit in a room and they usher Farage in and, you know, offer him a briefcase full of sort of, untraceable bonds or gold bars and say, we're buying you off, Farage. Probably not. Now, I don't believe that Farage has struck that kind of deal. What I think has happened with Farage is every time the establishment have needed a sort of right of centre party to act as a blockade against parties like the BNP, they've built him up as their sort of best case scenario or their most useful candidate. And I think that backfired on them. I think they did use him as controlled opposition, but it backfired on them because he brought about Brexit. So there is controlled opposition that obviously works hand in glove with the state. And then there's controlled opposition that might be not working hand in glove with the state, but are used by the state and built up with the media for similar purposes. But that second category of controlled opposition, they can be dangerous for the state because you can end up building up the wrong person. And I think the state did build up the wrong person. They thought they were going to build up Farage at European elections, keep the BNP out. But in the end, they built a guy that defeated both Labour and the Tories and brought about Britain's exit from the European Union. So yeah, I would describe him as controlled opposition, but I'm not sure he works hand in glove with the state because he's done the state quite a lot of damage. And at the last general election, he did them an awful lot of damage. To see the Conservative Party shattered and to see so many people voting outside of the normal two-party paradigm, that's not what the establishment wants. And that is what Farage has helped to achieve, which in a way is a good thing. In a way, it's a good thing because previously he always had a habit of helping the Tories. You know, with Veritas, he helped the Tories by getting rid of Robert Kilroy Silk when he said they need to smash the Tories. When Boris Johnson got elected, Nigel Farage said, well, look, we need to help Boris because he was a Brexiteer. And that means we're not going to stand candidates in key Tory marginals because we don't want to stop the Tories getting in and let Labour in because we've got to get Brexit done. So on several occasions, he did help the Tories. In 2024, he didn't. He helped run them into the ground. You know, he helped ensure one of the most crushing defeats the Conservative Party have ever seen. So, yeah, I do think he's controlled opposition. But sometimes, you know, you think you're controlling someone and they get out of control. It's like one of those things where, you know, you bring in the cane toads to eat all of the pests that are eating the crop and you think job done. And 10 years later, you're up to your knees in cane toads and they've not only eaten all the pests eating the crops, but they've eaten the crops and the cane toads are a bigger problem than the pests ever were. And I think the establishment sees Farage a little bit like that now. He's becoming more of a thorn in their side. And he's becoming more of a thorn in their side because he owns a share in GB News. He's got his own show there. The older generation love him. You know, sort of boomer voters really, really like him. And historically, boomer voters are the ones least likely to vote for change, but not with Farage. You know, he's weaponized these people. And I think the establishment are a little bit scared of him, not because he's going to bring about the kind of ethno state we want, but because he is now shifting the political landscape in a way that could see the two-party oligarchy come to an end. He could, you know, end the Conservative Party. The fact that Reform have got more members than the Conservatives say a lot. So that's my sort of take on Farage-controlled opposition and his history. And I think I've been very factual. I've been very fair to him. I've said where he's had successes, but I've also said, you know, he is very, very bad at dealing with people. And when he does fall out with people, 45% of his MEPs leave. He falls out with Kilroy Silk. If there's another guy who's getting more publicity than him, he doesn't like it. He will get rid of them. So he is a flawed character. And that leads us on to Rupert Lowe. Now, I'm going to talk here about Rupert Lowe. Now, I don't know as much about Rupert Lowe as I do about Nigel Farage because he's relatively new. And my first impression of Rupert Lowe, if I take him on his word, the things he says, my first impression of Rupert Lowe is he's great. I've got to credit him. I've got to credit Rupert Lowe. He is a good guy. He's talking about mass migration. He's talking about demographics. He is talking about deportation. And he's not just talking about deporting illegal immigrants. He's saying, look, we need to get rid of 1 million illegal immigrants. Now, that's pretty good. You know, I mean, there are potentially around 2 million illegal immigrants here. So I'd like him to double his numbers. But, you know, getting rid of 1 million, that's a good talking point. And he's saying that. He's saying, look, we need to get rid of these migrants. And this is where the Farage problem starts to rear its head. And here's an article from the Telegraph. Rupert Lowe, Reform tried to silence me on migrants. MP claims he was targeted for criticising Nigel Farage's leadership. Rupert Lowe said Reform UK tried to silence him over his outspoken views on migration. The suspended MP said he'd been warned by the party's leadership but had refused to listen and was making no apologies for his comments. In a post on X on Sunday, Mr. Lowe called for 1 million illegal immigrants to be deported, saying Nigel Farage, the Reform leader, might not agree with him, but that's the right thing to do. Well, it is the right thing to do. I wholeheartedly agree with him there. And if that is true, that Reform and Farage are trying to silence him over his views on immigration, that is absolutely wrong. That is absolutely wrong. Now, at this point, you've got to say Rupert Lowe is a likable guy. You want an MP in Parliament talking about mass deportations. I don't think they're going to happen, but you want it. You want an MP in Parliament talking about migration, demographics, and Lowe is getting there. Lowe is getting to the point where he's talking about the things that we care about. But I'm just loading up a page here because he goes a step further. He doesn't just say we need to deport illegal immigrants. He goes after the grooming gangs. Now, to be fair to Farage, Farage has been quite good on the grooming gangs. He said, we need a full inquiry. You know, we need to know the truth about this. There needs to be proper investigation and there needs to be proper punishment. But Lowe goes further. Lowe goes to a place which I'd go here. This is what I think is good. Lowe's saying, like, we don't just need to know the truth about the grooming gangs. We need to deport them, and we need to deport their family members. We need to deport anyone that was complicit in the grooming scandal, that knew about it, that was helping it. Because a lot of these men who were doing it, they were being assisted by their wives, their cousins, their brothers, etc. And he's saying, they've got to go. And I completely agree. And hearing an MP talk like that, fantastic. I think wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. It's something we've all hoped for. It's something, you know, when I was in the BNP, we wanted Nick Griffin to be an MEP, MP, so he could get up in Parliament and say this kind of thing. But Rupert Lowe saying it now, that's a good thing. And then this comes out. And this is even more worrying, and another black mark against Nigel Farage, if true. The Telegraph reports, Farage, no way back for Lowe after rape gang claims. Rupert Lowe suspended from Reform over bullying allegations, accused the party of silencing him on the Rotherham scandal. Nigel Farage says there's no way back into Reform UK for Rupert Lowe after he made a series of allegations about the rape gang's scandal. The Reform leader accused his former MP of wanting to cause maximum destruction and damage after Mr. Lowe was suspended from the party last week over allegations of bullying. Mr. Farage's comments came after Mr. Lowe claimed that Reform had silenced him over Pakistani grooming gangs in an extraordinary broadside on social media. Speaking to the Telegraph, Mr. Farage confirmed there would be no way back for the MP for Great Yarmouth, who now sits as an independent. Reform suspended Mr. Lowe on Friday and instructed an independent King's Council to investigate what it said were serious allegations of bullying. The party also reported Mr. Lowe to the police, da 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 da. All of the accusations have been denied by Mr. Lowe. In a post on X, Mr. Lowe said, there have been repeated attempts from within Reform, including senior leadership, to silence me on the Pakistani rape gangs. And the fact he calls them rape gangs, very, very good. He says, at a speech in Essex, I was instructed by Farage's team, sanctioned by him, to remove a call to deport all complicit foreign national family members. Ah, I'm slightly wrong there. Just complicit foreign national family members. So it's not as strong as I thought. I take that back. He doesn't say deport the grooming gangs. He says foreign national family members. He says he ignores that. My repeated pleadings for Reform to follow up his promise to deliver a national cry into the rape gangs were ignored. There was a belief from senior Reform figures that my language on the rape gangs was too strong, too robust, too tough. Mr. Lowe accused Mr. Farage and Reform of giving false hope to millions about the scandal, which returned to the news agenda after it was heavily publicised by Elon Musk, a tech billionaire who owns X. And then it goes into stuff about the grooming gangs, and we all know about the grooming gangs and how bad they were. So Farage says, effectively, this isn't true. There's no way back, he's lying. That Farage is saying, like, he didn't silence him. This is untrue. Lowe is saying they have attempted to silence him. Farage is saying, no. That's not true. There's no way back. He can't come back because he's lying about us. Now, I don't know who to believe. You can say, well, I believe Farage. You can say, you believe Lowe. You can say, on balance of their characters, who you believe. But we can't know for sure. That is a fact. The one thing is, only they know the truth on this. Simple as that. So far, neither have presented any evidence. But so far, I've got to say that out of the two of them, my initial sympathies would go to Rupert Lowe. Would go to Rupert Lowe, because he's saying the right things. Although I was wrong, he didn't say he's going to deport the grooming gangs, and that's very important. He said he'd deport any complicit foreign national family members, which is a lot weaker, to be honest. You know, deporting foreign national criminals is something that should be done automatically anyway. It's not really what I would say would be a radical policy. But he has said some more radical things. And the next thing I'm going to talk about is something that really impressed me about Rupert Lowe, because it's easy to talk about sort of grooming. It's easy to talk about mass deportations or mass immigration because it's more mainstream. But Rupert Lowe did an interview where he actually said that we needed to start thinking about repealing the Race Relations Act. Now, I've never heard anyone talk about something like that other the nationalists, other than people like myself. I remember, you know, Nick Griffin and leading members of the BNP giving speeches. You know, one of the things we'll do as soon as we get to power, they say, is repeal the Race Relations Act. Repeal the Race Relations Act, because it's stifling free speech. It does nothing for the country. And that's a really, really important point. I felt that was a, you know, superb thing for him to say. And I never thought I'd see an MP say something like that, because he's talking about unpicking the fundamentals of the multiracial, multicultural system. You know, he's talking about picking apart the patchwork quilt that's been built up over time that stifles white people, creates two-tier justice, and essentially gags us from telling the truth about things such as the Pakistani rape gangs, as Rupert Lowe calls them. So I was impressed by him, and I felt a lot of things he's saying were really pertinent, really important. And I was starting to be a bit of a fan. Now, the last thing I'll say about Lowe, and this takes me back to the first thing I said about Farage. I said, we're not going to slate Nigel Farage for being a banker or for being part of the financial industry, because Lowe comes from the same place. Now, if you look at Rupert Lowe's Wikipedia, Rupert Lowe has had a very, very similar sort of private sort of career life as Nigel Farage. So if you're going to attack Nigel Farage and say he can't be trusted because he's a part of the banking sector, you know, stockbroker, in with the financiers and the globalists and the money men, well, the same is absolutely true of Rupert Lowe. So take that as you will. But that's why at the very beginning, I didn't hold that against Nigel Farage, because we're holding against Farage, we've got to hold it against Lowe. You can't hold it against Farage and not hold it against Lowe, because they come from the same background. Now, you can hold it against Farage, but then you have to hold it against this man here. He has been quite impressive, so I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. So what do I think may or may not have happened that caused the bust-up between Lowe and Farage? And it might not be one of these things, it might be multiple. And I've put down four things, and this is where we start sort of speculating and theory crafting. Now, I've been in nationalism for a long time, and one thing you get in nationalists or nationalist circles or sort of dissident circles is mavericks, sort of these crazy maverick types. And these crazy maverick types, they seem great. They come into your organization with a lot of energy. They want to smash the system. But when they're in your organization has a system, and they often want to then smash that because they're in your organization, and they're opposed not just to the system in the big wide world, but they're opposed to the system, any system that they come up against. And I've seen that in the BNP. We had radicals and mavericks join the party, and you know, they were going to do it their way, and they were joining the BNP because it was an outsider group. But as soon as the BNP had a system or a protocol or a way of doing something they didn't like, they'd then attack the BNP. Now, it might be that Rupert Lowe is difficult to get on with. It might be that he's a bit of a maverick. It might be, like many people in sort of outsider politics, that he just doesn't get on with people, and he regularly rubs up against people the wrong way. That might be the case. I don't know. But it is certainly something that you have to think about. And that theory is also bolstered somewhat by the fact that this all really kicked off between him and Nigel Farage when he did an interview criticising, or that's the polite way of putting it, or slagging off Nigel Farage. Now, that's not too wise, is it? You know, if you go to the press and talk ill of your boss or the person above you in the pecking order, there is going to be some comeback, and it's not a professional thing to do. You know, if Angela Rayner went to the newspapers and told everyone Keir Starmer was an absolute div and shouldn't be running the country, you'd think that she wouldn't be deputy prime minister much longer. Similarly, when members of the cabinet under Johnson or Sunak criticised their respective leaders, they had to step aside. That is something that happens within all parties. So, you know, it wasn't the best thing for Rupert Lowe to go to the press and to publicly criticise the party he's part of, and to publicly criticise the leader and very successful leader of that party, Nigel Farage. So maybe, maybe not. That might bear out some truth that he is a little bit of a maverick, you know, etc. Now, my second theory is that the security services are in some way involved in this. Now, I think the security services will have been warned that they need to do whatever they can to undermine reform. And I think they will be undermining reform. And the security service will be doing that because, as I've said earlier, reform pose the most realistic threat to the two-party oligarchy that any party has ever posed. They are now in parliament. They have 215,000 members. And if they had held it together and motored forward, heading in to the next election, which will obviously be at the latest 2029, they were, you know, being tipped to maybe win between 50 and 100 seats, which would upend the two-party system in Britain. And it could well be that Rupert Lowe is a really nice guy, he's a really good guy, but he has aspirations like every man. And the security services have been planting people around him, whispering in his ear, and he potentially has been turned against people in his own party, and rifts and gulfs have been created between him and others in reform by the security services. I'm sure that's happened with nationalist organisations, and I'm sure that the security services that want to keep the current status quo going for as long as they can, potentially indefinitely, wouldn't rule out action like that, getting people into dissident parties, regardless of how weak they are, but they do pose some threat to the state, and breaking them up to ensure that they never get like critical mass. So firstly, it might be that he's a maverick. Secondly, it might be that people have been whispering in his ear and that he was pushed to this, or ideas or seeds were planted in his mind that he should go against the party leadership. And finally, my third theory is that Farage could be this big bad guy. He's fallen out with a lot of people. He's rumoured to be jealous. You know, he may not like the attention that Rupert Lowe's getting. He might not like Rupert Lowe's hardline talk about, you know, mass deportations, etc. Farage might think that could, you know, compromise the gains they're making. So it could be that Farage is difficult to get on with. He does have a history of that. You know, he lost 45% of his MEPs that were elected in 2009. He fell out with his, you know, with Robert Kilroy Silk. You've seen all the leaders that came and go in UKIP, and you've seen all the times that he's resigned only to be begged back. He's probably a difficult guy to work with. He's probably got a big ego. You know, I've heard from people who have worked with him that he isn't the easiest guy to get along with. And finally, there is sort of a fourth. There is a fourth sort of theory. Could it be a mix of all three? Could Lowe be hard to work with? A bit of a maverick. You know, somebody drips something in his ear, and coupled with that, Nigel Farage being the man he is, being a little bit jealous, being a bit sort of blustery, they clash. I don't know. You know, these are human beings, and between human beings, human issues turn up. But I don't think this will just be as simple as people are saying, sort of on X, and some of the content creators have sort of written this up in a very sort of, I'm not going to say childlike, but a very simplified way, sort of Lowe good, Farage bad, fell out because Farage is bad. Farage hasn't done anything. Lowe's going to lead us to victory. Boom. I don't think it's that simple. I don't think these things are ever that simple. And for my time, or for a decade in a political party that at one time was winning seats at a national level in the European Parliament, these personal clashes came about all the time. And sometimes they came about because a poisonous individual was sitting on the shoulder of somebody, dripping words of discontent in their ear and stoking things. We'll never know if those people were just malcontents, were they freaks, were they people who just like personal drama, or were they being paid by the state to do it, or were they state operatives themselves? And you'll see why I'm saying this as we draw close to the end of what we're getting to. You know, I think Lowe shouldn't have gone to the media. I think since he went to the media, and before he went to the media, there was a whispering campaign. And I think this could be an engineered split. Now, what are the likely outcomes? What are the likely outcomes of this with Rupert Lowe? Well, there's five likely outcomes. The first is that everything stays as it is. Now, currently he's suspended from reform. He's sitting as an independent. He could remain as an independent. He could continue sitting in Parliament as an independent MP. He's independently wealthy, massively so. I believe he was once in charge of Southampton Football Club. So he's not short of a few quid. He's a multi-millionaire. He'll be getting paid very well to be in Parliament. He'll be enjoying what he does there. He could carry on being an independent, seek re-election in 2029 or just at the next general election. He could carry on doing that. And that's where he is. That's one option. The second option, and this for me would be the best option if we want to see the Conservative Party destroyed, is that ultimately what you're going to get is a situation, the best thing would be if him and Farage sat down in a room, and that's what they should do. Farage should sit down with Rupert Lowe, and they should say to one another, you know what? We've got this far. We've got 5 seats in Parliament. We're doing very well. No one's ever done what we're doing, and no one's ever got as far as we've got. The Conservatives are on the back foot. Labour voters are now considering voting for us all in these red, you know, all across the red wall seats. Next general election, we could force either a coalition victory between us and the Tories, forcing things to the right, or we could end up with a hung parliament and literally end the two-party system as people have known it post-Second World War. That would be what I think they should do. Farage and Lowe should set their egos aside. They should come to an agreement. They should thrash it out like men. And they should not risk what they've got at this juncture. If they keep going at it, if they can't resolve their issues, if, as Farage says, there's no way back for Lowe, then that will be unfortunate. And I think it could damage the morale in the party. Farage has got, as we said, this way of sort of bouncing back from these things. He's always historically done that. But I think some people will be depressed about this. I think it will take some of the wind out of their sails. And, you know, but it might not, because let's face it, Rupert Lowe isn't a household name. Most people don't know who their own MPs are. I should imagine most people, if you ask them to name, you know, 2 or 3 people in the cabinet, they wouldn't be able to do it. So maybe they'll just be like, well, Reform's on the ballot, we're voting for them. You know, that's always what's happened in the past. You know, let's see what happens there. But for me, option one is he carries on as an independent and just, you know, that's what he goes. But for me, the best option is option two. And option two is that him and Nigel sit down in a room, have a couple of beers or coffees or whatever, and just thrash it out. The third, and I think this is the most likely outcome, is that he starts his own new party. And this is going to be very bad. This isn't something that would be good for Reform. And it's something that would help the establishment. I think he'll start his own party. There's already talk of him and Ben Habib. Ben Habib is the half, I think he's Pakistan, half Pakistani guy. He was formerly in Reform. I think Rupert Lowe and Ben Habib are in talks. They are discussing starting their own party, which will focus on things such as remigration to some degree, deporting illegals effectively. That's going to be the big thing, deporting illegals, not really remigration. He's not talking about getting rid of people who are citizens. He's talking about getting rid of up to 1 million illegal immigrants. And he's talking about setting up his own party. Now, he is independently incredibly wealthy. He's a multimillionaire. As I said, he used to be the director of a football club. He used to be a banker and broker. This guy has got a lot of clout. He's got a lot of cash. And with Ben Habib and others that would probably flock around him, that because they've also got grievances with Nigel Farage, they could form their own party. That would not be good, because then you've got sort of Reform and another party, a little bit like Reform, but without Farage fighting it out. And then you've got a situation which is rather similar to what you had in 2004, when Farage and Kilroy Silk were friends, but fell out and Kilroy Silk said he wanted a more radical party, set up Veritas. And you know, by the end of 2005, that was all, you know, done and folded up and over. So that's, I think, a likely outcome. The fourth outcome is that he doesn't start his own party. He doesn't start his own party. He could join another smaller party. Now, I don't think he'll do that. I think if he was likely to join any, there's numerous. There's Lawrence Fox's Reclaim Party. Now, the Reclaim Party had an MP at one point. One of the Tories actually defected to Reclaim. This is how fickle people are. You know, one minute Lawrence Fox starts a party, the next minute it's got an MP, the next minute the MP quits, and he's not got an MP. But he could go to something like Lawrence Fox's party. He could go to David Curtin's Heritage Party. He could try to resurrect what's left of UKIP. He could go to a party like the English Democrats. All of those things are on the table. I don't think he would go any further right than that. I don't think he's going to join an ethno-nationalist party. But he could go to a smaller party. He could go to a smaller party as sort of like a celebrity candidate. But I think if he did that, he would want to lead that party. I don't think he's going to go into some tiny party without any elected officials and sit there and serve under someone else. I think if he's going to be in a party, he's going to be in a party that he controls and that he shapes and that he writes the constitution and that he spearheads. I mean, you know, having an MP and that MP not being the leader of the party is kind of odd, really. You know, generally speaking, if a party has an MP, unless it's some sort of like mainstream defector that you're not really sure of. But look, this guy would want to be leader. I'm just telling you that now. If he's going to a small party, I think he'd want to be leader of that party. So I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think he's going to try and resurrect one of these small parties that stands in by-elections and gets sort of 0.8% of the vote. I just can't see him doing that. If he joined any of them, I'm going to echo what Toffee's saying in the chat. If he joined any of them, I think he'd join David Curtin's Heritage Party because there'd be some sort of synergy there in that they're people who fell out with Farage say similar things. And I think, you know, in some respects, there could be some sort of like super team formed where you have sort of Ben Habib, David Curtin, you have Rupert Lowe, and they sort of gang together and create something new. I think that could be that could be something that may happen, but I still think he'll start his own party. And the fifth option is that he sort of gets embroiled in some kind of toxic witch's brew where he sort of flits between different groups and parties. He turns up on sort of alternative podcasts. He ends up at a Tommy Robinson rally. He ends up on the Lotus Eaters. You know, he associates with numerous different groups, does an interview with, you know, somebody who potentially said ethno-nationalist things in the past, and he ends up going down the Gerard Batten route where he thinks he's bringing in all this new blood, you know, opening up the political discussion, and then ends up getting completely hammered like he did. And by the way, I don't think Gerard Batten's a bad person. He's a really nice guy. I think he, you know, I think I'd have probably a lot in common with him. I kind of like the things he did and said, but it's true that he didn't do very well with the coalition he tried to build, and it ended up being a little bit of a witch's brew that led to him and UKIP getting absolutely stomped by the Brexit Party, as we discussed earlier. So they're the five options. That's where he could go. Now, who does this all benefit? And this is really my conclusion. This is where we come to an end, and we're going to go to the questions in a second. So if you've got something to super chat, if you've got something to ask, ask away, and I will answer your questions very, very shortly. So anything you've got to ask, I will answer. But this is the reality, and this is the sad reality of this situation. Reform, we're getting to that position of breaking the two-party system, breaking down this sort of post-war oligarchy. And the only party, the only people that will benefit from this split, the only people that will benefit from Lowe and Farage being at each other's throats, is unfortunately the Conservative Party. And that's sad, but it's a fact. This will re-establish that status quo. And I said earlier, I think maybe the security services might have been whispering in people's ear or trying to engineer this. And do you know why I said that? Because this isn't happening in a vacuum. At the same time that this split, this fallout, this fracture is happening, the Tories are going all out to talk up their anti-immigration, almost anti-establishment, you know, pro-English, pro-British talking points, you know, and I'm not making this up. Suella Braverman, Google it. She came out recently and said, well, I can't be English. What, Suella? You're acknowledging that the English are a distinct ethnicity and you can't be English? Yes, she was. Suella Braverman, writing in, and I believe it was The Telegraph, said she couldn't be English because the English are an ethnicity and you need to be white to be English because they're an ethnic group like Scots or the Welsh or, you know, we are distinct ethnic groups. And she can't be English. She can be British. She can hold a British passport. She can be a British citizen, but she can't be Indigenous. Well, that's massive, isn't it? You've got a, you know, former government minister and Tory frontrunner coming out and saying that the English are a distinct ethnic group. Why is she saying that? Then you've got Robert Jenrick standing up in Parliament, having a go at the sentencing council and attacking Labour, saying that this is two-tier justice. This is essentially anti-white male. This is two-tier. He's using terms that we would use. You know, it wasn't long ago that the Home Office came out and said that the term two-tier justice or two-tier policing was far-right extremism. And here's Robert Jenrick using it in Parliament. And of course, you've got Kemi Badenoch, who's the final part of this. And she's saying, look, the people want anti-immigration politicians. We're going to give them it and we're going to lock these migrants out. We're going to secure our border. Well, love, you had 14 years to do that and you were a government minister and you failed completely. But here you are. Here you are selling that you're the anti-immigration party. So on one hand, you've got this split coming at the same time as you have the Tories going on this all-out assault, making what are essentially sort of Mark Collett ethno-nationalist talking points. You know, the English are an ethnic group. You can't become English. You're born English. You can't become English. And you can only be born English if you're, you know, from English parents. What? We've been saying that for years and we were called racist for saying it. Oh, we want to stop all migration. Since when? Well, they do now. And they're using, you know, terminology that just a month or so ago, the Home Office was saying was, you know, far right extremism. Why are they doing this? Because they are trying to steal Reform's thunder. And at the same time that they're trying to steal Reform's thunder, Reform are having these internal problems. And when I see things like this, I genuinely wonder if the state is playing a game here. You know, the Tories have even started to talk about deporting foreign criminals and ensuring that illegal migrants are deported. You know, the same stuff that Reform should be pushing, the same things that we push. And I've got to say this. The Conservatives have a long history of doing this. Most notably, they did it in 1979 when the National Front were doing very, very well. And they basically, Margaret Thatcher and the Tories actively went out of their way. And you can look this all up. It's all true. They took, you know, they went out of their way to steal the National Front's talking points, to head them off, to ensure that people voted Tory instead of National Front. And that's why I believe that this is something that has been engineered. And that's why I'm going to put my flag in the sand here right now and say this. This fallout and reform is good for one thing only, and that's propping up the establishment. It's not good for Lowe. It's not good for Farage. It's not good for the British people. It's not going to speed the decline of the current anti-white system. If anything, it will do the opposite. This is what happens when the state are attempting to prop up a system that is collapsing. And not that I think Farage or Lowe, who both of them I've praised tonight and both of them I've given some criticism to, I don't think they would, they might not watch this. I doubt they'll watch this. But if they were, my advice would be sort out your differences and don't let the Conservatives recover from the wound you inflicted upon them in 2024. The Reform Party is far from perfect, but if it deals a fatal blow to the Conservatives, that would change the electoral system in this country forever. It would completely change the political landscape, and that's what we need. And that's why Reform, despite not being perfect and despite not being ethno-nationalists, are a threat to the system. And that is exactly why the security services may well have played some role in engineering this public bust-up. And that's my thoughts on it all, and I hope you enjoyed it. Anyway, what I'm going to do now is answer the Super Chats. And we do have some very generous Super Chats tonight, so thank you so much for everyone who has Super Chatted. And once we've done that, I will answer any unpaid questions. Somebody said in the chat, by the way, I'm just going to address this. I said born English. Well, you are born English, but only English people can give birth to English people. You know what I mean? That's sort of like I misspoke when I said that. Being English is something that, you know, is in your genetics. It's in your DNA. You cannot become English. You cannot achieve Englishness. You can't fill out a citizenship test. You are either born English or you are not born English. That is what I mean. When, you know, you come to Britain, you can fill out a citizenship test and apply for a passport. There is no English passport. You are either English or you're not. English is an ethnicity, which is passed down genetically. It's passed down via birth. You're either born English or you're not born English. And being born English doesn't necessarily mean being born on English soil. I know Englishmen who were, you know, born to two English parents on military bases abroad. I think that's a pretty clear position on that. But just to clarify that, in case anyone in the chat was thinking I was saying that, you know, somebody born on English soil is English. No, that's not how it works. Anyway, let's do these Super Chats. So Thin Red Ligo, $5. Thank you so much. Said, it seems to be more important to defeat Farage than the Tories. Farage seems to be a sprinter. Maybe the way to defeat him is to campaign directly against him, make him do a marathon and stay longer in politics. I don't think you're going to defeat Farage. I think Farage, as I said tonight, he can always be resurrected. He's a very tenacious guy. I also think he's a favourite amongst the public. And what you've got to remember, one of the reasons why Farage always comes back is because people know him. He's a household name. Rupert Lowe sadly isn't a household name, but Farage is. And that means something to people. Like I said, most people couldn't name their own MP. Most people couldn't name more than two people in the cabinet. You know, probably most people don't even know who the deputy prime minister is. You know, they certainly don't know who the shadow cabinet are. And they're important roles. So they're not going to know who Rupert Lowe is. Outside of the Twitter X sort of bubble, and people like us, they're not going to know who he is. Farage is not really directly defeatable because he is a household name. So the media can pull him out and he can resurrect. As long as he gets the oxygen of publicity, people will tend towards him because he is so well known. And he is loved by your sort of GB news viewers. He's loved by the sort of boomer voter. He's established himself. When he's been in politics, you know, successfully in politics as an elected politician in one form or another for 2.5 decades, that sticks in people's minds. So there you go. Ethno-nationalist gave 1488. Thank you so much. So congratulations, Mark and family, on the birth of your son, 1488. Well, thank you so much, my friend. Having another child in the house is truly a wondrous thing. Absolutely Zero gave $50. Thank you so much. So congratulations to you and Mrs. Mark on your newborn son. Here's a couple of bucks to celebrate with a couple of Red Bulls. Well, thank you, my friend. That's very generous. Lacey Setter gave $50. Thank you so much. So greetings from Finland and belated congratulations on your newborn son. Well, thank you so much. It's very much appreciated. Jay Bradley gave $10. Thank you so much and said, hi, Mark, off topic, but have you ever read or listened to Which Way Western Man by William Galley Simpson? If so, what did you make of it? No, I haven't, but I'd be willing to read it and potentially review it. Thank you so much. David Peterson gave $100. Thank you so much for your generosity. He said, keep up the great work. Well, thank you so much. I'm pleased you enjoyed tonight's stream. And that takes us to the end of the paid questions. So not many paid questions and not many questions about Farage or Lowe or my opinions on it. Hopefully that's a sign that I gave a comprehensive presentations. But there are some unpaid questions. People are asking things in the chat. And remember, you can ask things in the chat for free. I'll monitor it for the next few minutes. and I'll answer them free of charge. I don't want people to have their questions neglected because they didn't have enough money to donate, etc. I know that not everyone has got money to donate or feel comfortable putting their credit card details into. So, you know, I'm game for a few more minutes. Lewis B said, "Hi, Mark Collett. Why don't Reform embrace alt media? Some of these podcast shows get hundreds of thousands and millions of views, but will choose the TV every time. It is a snobby class issue. Is it a snobby class issue? And they look at these shows as stuff for us plebs." Well, there is sort of, like, look, Sargon of Akkad and the Lotus Eaters are pretty big. Tommy Robinson is pretty big. But look what happened when Gerard Batten embraced them. It was disastrous. Now, Nigel Farage has got something that no other politician who is right of the Conservative Party has ever had. And that is access to his own media channel. Nigel Farage has got GB News. Now, GB News is mainstream. It's seen as respectable. They get invited to things like, you know, Prime Minister's press statements and, you know, proper events. You know, they get press passes, etc. Having that is very important. It gives them a degree of respectability. Nigel Farage always neglected to do these sort of smaller podcasts, sit chatting to somebody like myself, you know, doing this from a home office, etc., because he thinks it diminishes his standing. And he notes that no other politicians, no mainstream politicians do that. And so far, he's been proven right, because every time somebody has attempted to embrace the content creation sphere, whether it be in America or the UK, they have generally fared very badly for doing so. The only exception would be Trump's appearance on Joe Rogan. But Joe Rogan is the biggest podcast in the world, which is, again, very different, very, very different from appearing on a small YouTube show. You know, I would say that for Farage now, with the position he's got, especially with GB News, it would be a major climb down from his point of view to sit doing YouTube shows, etc. And, you know, he said that, to be fair, about, you know, Gerard Batten when he took that thing. And I thought Gerard Batten taking that route was very interesting, but it didn't work. And that's not to insult Gerard Batten. I'm sure he's a really nice guy and he said some things I really agree with, but it didn't work for him as an electoral strategy. Now, what does work as an electoral strategy and what has been proven is getting mainstream coverage. And Farage is the master of that. And he now has a mainstream channel on Sky that every conservative minded boomer loves. That's GB News. And they plug him constantly. So, yeah, he isn't going to go lower than the position he's in, because he feels it would diminish his position, and it has been proven to do so. And somebody said, "I still don't get what the difference is between the Tories and Farage at this point." Well, that's a good argument. What is the difference? I mean, from a voter's perspective, the Conservatives repeatedly got elected on the basis that they wanted to end immigration and never did so. So, you know, normal people are going to say, we're not voting for them anymore. They failed. And the Conservatives were coming to the end of a 14-year tenure in power. People were sick of them. And people see Farage as a man, like I said earlier, who can not only win, but when he does win, he creates actual tangible change to society, like he did with Brexit. He's achieved so much that people will put their faith in him, because really the Brexit vote was the only time that the liberal establishment took a step back. You know, Britain's exit from the European Union was seen as a major defeat for the liberal left establishment. And it was seen as a win for the normal guy on the street. Now, it didn't work out that way, because all it did was lead to more non-white immigration from all over the world. But it was seen as a win by people who wanted to push back against the system. And Farage delivered that, so people will put their faith in him. So, anyway, I can't see any more questions. I hope everyone's really enjoyed the stream. And I want to say a huge thank you to everyone who donated so generously. I will be back next week at 7 p.m. on Wednesday for Patriotic Weekly Review with a new guest. People aren't going to believe who it is. I'll leave you guessing for a while. Oh, we've got another paid super chat here. Jagdeep Jaino gave $5. Thank you much. Said, did you see Keir Starmer walk over to Farage in Parliament and shake his hand a few months ago? Also, why was Farage rehabilitated by the media? He went from being number one villain to winning IMSA. I don't think he actually won I'm a Celebrity. I think he came second. Nama crazily thinks Farage may be primed to lead us into a war in the future. I think the media build him up for a variety of reasons. I've explained that before. They build him up because it prevents anything further to the right growing and taking root. But it's a dangerous game because he's not fully on board with all of their belief systems. And sometimes he throws a curveball like Brexit. Now, why do I think Keir Starmer and Farage shake hands? Well, sadly, all of these people can sit in the same room with one another, criticize each other and shake hands like you do after a game of football. And I've never understood this. I don't know if I've pointed this out before or mentioned this before, but when I was in the BNP, I used to go to election counts and we would stand there as BNP members or BNP candidates. And we'd be like, everyone else in this room is really people we don't like, except for maybe the UKIP guys over there, you know, and we would look at the Labour people and we'd be like, if we could unseat you and do away with you, we wouldn't be shaking hands with you as you went out the building. We'd be laughing and jeering. But the others all play it like it's a game, like it's a, you know, you've had a game of football, it's been a hard fought 90 minutes, you shake hands, you swap shirts and you go back to the changing rooms. And that's how they act. And they all think that's a gentlemanly, decent way to act. But I, you know, that doesn't sit with me because, you know, when I look at people like Starmer, I see him jailing good people. I see him flooding this country with migrants. I see him destroying the very nation that I love. He's an enemy of mine. I wouldn't want to go over there and shake hands with him. Like, you know, we're playing a game of football, which is inconsequential. But it's a different mindset. We have a different mindset to people within the establishment. It's as simple as that. And yeah, Neil McRae is a great writer. He's written some stuff for the Occidental Observer and for other sites. I suggest people support him. He came to the PA conference last year. He's a real gentleman and a really lovely guy. So yeah, keep up the good work, Neil. Your output is very much appreciated. Anyway, that brings it to the show. Brings us to the end of the show. We've got a great guest next week for Patriotic Weekly Review at 7 p.m. on Wednesday. I just want to say a huge thank you to everybody who donated so very generously. A huge thank you to everyone who tuned in and participated. I hope you enjoyed the stream and I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Thank you, everybody, and good night.